I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. You know, if you read any newspaper or magazine article that contains the word generation, I bet it's either about how, you know, the baby boomers have ruined the world, or it's about how ridiculous millennials are. And honestly, what I'd really put money on is that it doesn't mention that there's a whole generation, Gen X, between them that kind of hates them both. But the point is, most of the discussion is about how different generations kind of can't stand each other. But in food, it's almost the opposite, right? Meaning people are totally romantic about the idea of generational shifts, of passing the torch or taking up the mantle or whatever you want to call it. I mean, think of the pizza place where the owner used to be the kid doing her homework in the corner, or the grocer where the family photos on the wall go slowly from laser printouts back to black and white portraits. People love those places. Like anything, the passing of generations is sometimes beautiful, sometimes hard, sometimes confusing, and often all at once. And that's what we're talking about this week on the show. From family farms to restaurants to retired food critics talking to up-and-comers. Okay, so I got a box of peaches as a gift this summer, and I wish I could tell you, really, like, describe to you how perfect they were. They did all the things great peaches do. They were sweet and just a little sour, and you had to eat them over the sink because the juice would run down your arm. But maybe the most wonderful thing about them is that you could smell them not when you walked into the kitchen, but when you opened the front door of my apartment. But actually, no. Because really, the most wonderful thing about them was where they came from. The Masumoto family farm in California, run now by the second and third generations of that family, the father and daughter team of Mas and Nikiko Masumoto. Now, Nikiko told her family years ago that she would never come back to the farm, but eventually changed her mind. And she and her father are poetic and complex, and we wanted to talk with them about what it's like for them to pass the torch. Nikiko and Mas, it's so great to have you.
We're so glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to be inside.
Okay, so Nikiko, when you and I last talked, I think literally 5 years ago, we were talking about how when you were younger, you left the family farm to go to college, and at that time you thought you would never want to return, and you would come back, and you were learning all these skills about what it takes to be a farmer, but also the emotional work of coming back and being so present and so physical with your family. How has it been since?
I can't believe it's been 5 years since we spoke last. It's amazing. The farm, it has been richer, deeper, and harder than I think I even imagined the last time we spoke.
Really? In what ways?
I think that one of the gifts of farming with family is going through all of the seasons, not only of the year and the natural cycle of the farm, but really all of the seasons of life and navigating crisis, navigating joy, navigating envy and worry about each other. That terrain, the emotional terrain, has been just almost sacred for me as I get to farm with my father, work with my mother and my brother, and now I'm married, and so get to welcome my wife into our farm and family.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's been incredible.
Yeah. Mas, when you were younger, I understood that you also once thought that you would leave the farm and not return. And so you never pressured Nikiko to come back. How did it feel when she said she wanted to?
Oh, I was shocked and surprised. You're right. When I was younger, I'm the youngest of the family, so I was the last hope, because my older brother and older sister clearly were not going to come back to the farm. And I probably broke my dad's heart by telling him I'm not ever going to come back. I can remember the day it happened. I was a bad electric guitar player, and I was playing this Led Zeppelin song, you know, saying, "Dad, I'm never going to come back to farm," you know. But then, you know, long story short, I ended up circling back to the farm for many, many reasons. But one was I just, you know, loved the life there, and I loved the family part of it. But one of the lessons that I learned was I came back to the farm because my dad allowed me to leave the farm. And I said, that's the same lesson I want to pass on to Nakiko, that allowing her to leave may be the only way she comes back to the farm. And that's what happened. And it was, you know, this wonderful moment because it literally changed things on the farm, such as the timeline. So instead of measuring how many harvests do I have left, it was now how many harvests do we have left. And it extended the way we looked at the farm, the longevity of things, how we could literally make plans in terms of what orchards to plant. Because I wasn't going to plant a new orchard, because I think a new orchard will take at least 15 to 20 years for the flavors of the peaches and the nectarines to really, really arrive. And I don't know if I wanted to wait until my 80s to find that out. But now with Nakiko, it's clearly a different timeline.
Dad, do you remember the first orchard we planted together, the Rose Diamond?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Our Rose Diamond nectarines. I was 19 years old, and so I had just made the decision that I wanted to come back and farm, but I was still in college. So I came home to help plant this orchard, these knee-high nectarine trees, and we were shoveling, and you looked up at me, a tree over, and said, "Nakiko, this orchard will be full grown when you're 40. And my eyes, I think, I was like 19 and like 40 had never entered into my consciousness yet.
And it's a wonderful way to measure time on a farm and a family, to have this understanding of that generational transitions that occur, and how that's how long it takes to form partnerships. So people have asked, well, what's it like to have Nakiko taking over the farm? And I don't like that term at all.
I don't either.
Yeah, taking over implies that either one, they're pushing you away and pushing you out, and they're going to take over something. Really, it's a partnership that we have now. And like all partnership, it has its moments of joys and moments of challenges too. But you live and work through that partnership.
How do you deal, though, when there are disagreements? Yeah, I was just watching the show about this restaurant that's like three generations deep. And when the daughter came back, her parents wouldn't let her change anything. So she waited until they went away on vacation, and she would immediately buy a new dishwasher or whatever. And it sounded like it worked for them, but that doesn't sound very emotionally healthy.
Well, so. And my dad never goes on vacation. Francis, I think I know the show you're talking about. And I so bonded with that chef when she was describing. I think one of the challenges is, well, first of all, my dad and I, just as individuals, we're both pretty fire spirits. And so when we encounter conflict, we just kind of dive head into the conflict. So I think one of the beautiful parts of farming with my dad, someone who I'm so alike, has been to learn some of the cooling effects of thinking about conflict as healthy and how to approach it in a healthy way. And I think a lot about my Jichan, my grandfather, who was a really quiet man. And I think he didn't like conflict very much. And I can imagine him, you know, getting in a little tiff or something with my Bachan, my grandmother, and going out to the shed or the fields to find solitude. And so I'm a really hot spirit. And so when I get mad, I try to get on the tractor or go find some solace with the trees. And it always has a calming effect for me.
And you should see the tractor work she does when she's mad.
It's excellent.
It's really fast, or it's sloppy and beats the crap out of the vines and trees and everything. So how do we handle the conflict? And that, you know, one, I'm much more verbal than my dad. So we talk a lot, but at the same time, one of my strategies is I step away. in the same way, because a lot of the conflicts don't require necessarily immediate resolution. On a farm, all the timelines are stretched out. So it takes time to think things through. And that's really the time that works great to step away and sort of work through it that way.
Mm-hmm. There's so much thinking. This is going to sound so incredibly woo-woo, but I know you guys are from California. Maybe it'll be fine for you. But I think there's so much thinking happens in the body. You know what I mean? Mm. In that your thinking changes, your perspective changes on like where your body is and what your body's feeling. And I can only imagine what it must be like when you have such a connection to this land that your family has had for so long, and you can walk amongst these trees and you can do your thinking that way.
Well, it's also, I imagine, for anyone who works with food, food is visceral. It's all about this tactile relationship, this tactile touch that we have. You engage with your body, and that's exactly, I think, how we want to think things through. It's not just cerebral that we could just figure it out with a new spreadsheet or something like that. Sure. It's actually trying to work it out both in a intellectual and emotional and physical way. And all food is that way. All food involves emotions and a personal connections. And that's how we approach our farming. And hopefully our peaches, nectarines, and raisins represent that too, that there's this connection, this connective tissue that people could find in food.
That's beautiful. Nihiko, earlier Moss said that you guys kind of resist this idea of, is passing it along to you. Mm-hmm. But from your perspective, do you think about what it will be like when your father does eventually decide, you know what, I think I'm not going to be out in the farm the same way anymore?
Gosh, when you just said that, I get chills down my back. Yes, I think about it a lot. I know my dad. I know him through and through, and I know he's going to work on the farm until his last day because he loves it so much. So when I think about, whenever anybody mentions me being the farmer, I can't help but think about death and think about the day when I have to do this on my own. Yeah. And that's part of the richness of it, because it makes every day feel so precious. And it's also part of the weight of working with family and working with the land. And I so believe in ghosts and the ghosts of my great-grandparents walking on our farm. My grandfather, my Ji-chan, who I just adored, he's still with us. So that's when the courage really is conjured for me, that this journey of deciding to farm with my dad instead of starting my own farm, it really has required of me to make presence with mortality. And my dad also loves talking about it. He's planned his entire funeral, including the song he once played.
Is it the same Led Zeppelin song?
This is a country. This, yeah, a whole lot of love or something. It was a country western song, Cowgirls Don't Cry. And Nikiko doesn't laugh. I laugh thinking about it. In a similar way, my father had a stroke, and it changed our relationship on, because he wasn't going to work as much on the farm, but we got him back on a tractor, et cetera, et cetera. But I remember it made me think of his mortality and understanding this dynamic of what's it going to be like when he's no longer here. And I remember this moment. I was walking in the fields, and I started thinking about that and realizing that my father is part of this land. He planted these trees. I could see the marks that he made literally in the earth. And I realized that part of letting go my father was also understanding he will always be part of this farm. And in that sense, I was able to let go and realize his mortality would soon happen. And it was just this moment of both sadness and yet joy, because you realize there will be that connection. And I think that's how we see our farm, that I will always be part of this, no matter if I'm here physically or just in memory. And I think that's, again, that power of memory is so important to the work that we do on the farm. And I think of food, too, and how people relate to food through this power of memory.
Yeah. You guys are magnificent. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, our pleasure.
Nikiko and Mas Masumoto run the Masumoto Family Farm in Delray, California. And they're the authors of the cookbook, The Perfect Peach. Coming up, Soleil Ho and Ruth Reichel talk to each other about how the role of the restaurant critic has been totally transformed. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. And this week, we're all about what it's like when one generation passes work on to another. When we were planning this show, the first people I knew I wanted to hear from were Ruth Reichel and Soleil Ho. So Ruth started her career as a restaurant critic in the 70s, not long after she was a cook at, there's no other way to put it, a hippie co-op restaurant in Berkeley, California. But she went on to revolutionize restaurant criticism in the 90s while at the New York Times. She wrote reviews as stories. She went to restaurants in disguise, and she outraged her predecessor by raving about places that didn't fit the French fine dining mold. Soleil Ho is one of our country's newest big deal restaurant critics. She took over the job earlier this year at the San Francisco Chronicle. And she's also a former cook and, I think, is also revolutionizing restaurant criticism in her own way. And we wanted to get these two together, to hear them talk to each other about their challenges and, you know, what the role of the restaurant critic really even is. I gotta tell you, I could listen to them for hours.
I guess I'll start with this question. What did you feel you needed to change when you started writing reviews? I feel like I'm asking you for advice, and
okay,
I am just embracing that.
Okay, this is such a different time. You know, I came into restaurant criticism at a time when there were a handful of us who cared about food. I mean, almost nobody. And what I wanted to do was seduce people into going to restaurants, into eating good food. I wanted them to think about restaurants in new ways. And I had absolutely no interest in evaluating restaurants or, you know, saying that this dish had too much salt and that one, you know, needed to be closer to a Caesar salad. What I wanted to do was make Americans care about food and to be as excited about restaurants as I was, and to think about the people who were in the restaurants, both the people who were in the kitchen, the people who were waiting on them, and the people who were sitting around them. And so, you know, today the relationship between restaurant critics and restaurants themselves is kind of adversarial. It wasn't then, you know, I mean, to me, it was we, the people who were cooking the food and the people who were writing about it, we were all on the same team. And as time went on, I started seeing my role changing a little bit in that, you know, I honestly believe that cities get the restaurants they demand. And so, you know, after I'd been doing it, so I started in the mid-70s, and by the mid-80s, I was starting to think that it was really important that people be more demanding of restaurants, that food, the food in the city would be better if people didn't settle for mediocrity. What did you think you wanted to change?
So I was stepping into the job, you know, into the shoes of someone who had been in the position for 30 plus years, right? Michael Bauer was the San Francisco Chronicle's restaurant critic. He started before I was born, which is so humbling to me.
It's kind of amazing.
Right? I was barely a twinkle in my mother's eye when he started at the Chronicle. And so, you know, there was that I was inheriting, just that legacy and everything that he had built through his career in San Francisco and the Bay Area. And, you know, I got a lot of suggestions coming in from people, from chefs, just from readers, other writers of what I should do and how I should turn the boat, essentially. And the things that I really wanted to change or just really imbue the position with was that a similar sense of demand, I guess, as what you're articulating. Because I care a lot about diversity and diversifying the pool of people who get to make a living making food. You know, I think everyone from any group wants to, you know, make a living and be comfortable and have a life. And for a lot of people like immigrants, for a lot of working class entrepreneurs making food, be it like the tamale ladies that you see at the bar at midnight or someone who's aiming for a Michelin star, they want that same opportunity. And part of them receiving that is coverage from people like us. You know, investors see that, they read that coverage and they think, okay, maybe this person is a really safe investment. Maybe they're a really good one. And, you know, if you only write about a certain, you know, aesthetic or a certain type of person who makes food, then that's what the restaurant scene is kind of going to become. At least that was my hypothesis going in. But that's what I wanted to focus on and think about, really intentional coverage.
It's so interesting to me, though, because you're seeing your audience as much more than the readers of the newspaper, which is very different than how I ever thought of it. I mean, you're stepping into this role at a time when restaurants have become part of popular culture, and you're sort of understanding your impact in a way that it just never crossed my mind. It's so interesting to me because you're absolutely right. It's emblematic of what a different place restaurants have in the culture today. That you as a critic have, I think, a much bigger responsibility than people of my generation had.
Actually, I want to talk about that a bit because I find that really intimidating also. And I wanted to know what you would have to say about this. Because, you know, you're right that there is more responsibility. And I'm starting to kind of have these moments where I lose sight of what it's like to be a person.
Whoa.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does make sense. Because it's a heavy responsibility. I mean, it is. When you look at it with the notion of what your role in society is, I mean, it's very different than just being someone who, you know, is trying to get more readers for the newspaper. I mean, one of the things that really interests me about your generation of critic is that, you know, you're writing not just to readers, but to all of society. And you're also, you know, understanding your responsibility as, I hate this term, but it's a real one, a thought leader.
Oh, no. Yeah.
You know, it's a horrible term. It's a terrible it's a terrible term, and especially now that people are monetizing being thought leaders.
But, and influencers.
And
yeah.
Influencers, yes. You know, you do have a bully platform, and I think it is important, I mean, especially in this moment when, you know, we are finally understanding that one of the things that restaurants do that is truly important is they're an entry point for so many business people in this country. You know, it's where you can get a foothold and has been, you know, pretty much throughout American history. But as that ramps up, I mean, it really does become the critic's responsibility to go out and find people who investors should be investing in. I mean, not just eaters.
Yeah, it's heavy, right?
It's heavy.
That's people's lives.
It is heavy, but it's also wonderful, you know? I mean, it makes what you do much more valuable. You know, as my mother kept saying to me, you're just telling, you know, rich people where to go eat. And that's so not what you're doing today.
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like we're less embracing that and more just accepting our reality as well as millennials, right? Just so many of us are living paycheck to paycheck. And I think this is symptomatic of the wealth gap that's been widening since, I mean, at least I've noticed it widening since I graduated from college and realized like, oh, I was dumpster diving when I started food writing, you know? just having that background and understanding that, I think, has been really helpful for me, actually.
Well, I mean, I came at it from the same place. I mean, I had no money when I started, but I didn't see my responsibility in the same way that you'd. And I don't think it was. I mean, I think restaurants were very different at that moment.
I have to say, it's quite easy to be lulled into a sense of like normalcy when you go to like the places that have 3 Michelin stars and they treat you like, you know, royalty. And it's almost like flying first class, which I've only done like maybe 2 times in my life. And I'm just like, oh yeah, this is good. This is the way it should be. But it's not. But it's so easy when you're so comfortable. And this is me, though, being like I was going to say a bad word, but like being someone who likes to kick up a fuss, right? Since I've become the restaurant critic, I've been thinking about that idea of places where you just pay and you get in, you know, and how accessible that might be to people, right?
Right.
And so for me, what's been interesting is noticing the nuances and the wrinkles in that narrative. Like, for example, there are, you know, 3 Michelin-starred restaurants or just even fine dining places where, yes, you can pay the price of admission, but if you're, for example, like in a wheelchair, you don't get to go into the same entrance as everyone else, or, you know, you can't get that kind of accommodation. There's no menus in Braille, or there are no gender-neutral restrooms, like that sort of thing. And for me, that's the exciting part, too, is as a critic, is like really taking a look at all of this stuff and pulling it apart and really examining it, ripping out the guts.
Yeah, see, that's so interesting to me because I thought about those things, but not in the sense of menus should be in Braille or wheelchair entry. I mean, I was just thinking about, you know, how women, single women got treated terribly in restaurants,
right,
or old ladies were always treated badly in restaurants. And so, you know, I did all the disguises thing to see how badly I would be treated, and it was terrible. But I wasn't thinking of it in as broad a sense as you are. And, you know, it's wonderful that the world has expanded that much, that now, I mean, we really are thinking of inclusion in a much, much broader sense.
Yeah, and I guess it's a great thing, and I am more than willing to take up that mantle. But I guess, like I said earlier, it is hard to maintain a sense of self as a critic, especially now. You know, like I appreciate how you really laud this generation that I'm a part of, but it's also intimidating, you know, to be part of this legacy, to have all of this expectation on me and my peers. You know, I get compared to you all the time. And
you
that
do?
To me is the most terrifying thing in the world.
Oh, I'm so honored.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know, I mean, doing new stuff it's hard, but it's the only thing worth doing. You know, one of the things that makes me sad about what's happening with newspaper food sections and reviews is that I've always thought that food is such a great way to cover a local community, to introduce a community to the best of itself. And now people all over the country are reading you. So you're not thinking of yourself as, oh, this is exclusively Bay Area. And I think we're losing something in newspaper coverage as, you know, we have a few big papers and now they're trying to write for the entire country. You know, the New York Times is not writing for New York anymore. They think of themselves as a national paper. And I think you lose something when your focus broadens like that.
Yeah. My editors always ask about local hooks and things like that. But I do think that the themes that I try to bring into reviews are really like universal. Like I wrote a review of a Burmese restaurant, right?
And I got a lot of feedback.
Thank you. I got feedback from people who don't live in the Bay Area who were like, you inspired me to go to this local Burmese spot in, you know, where I live in D.C. or Arlington. And I thought that was really cool. So there's that side, too, where people still relate and they feel maybe a little bit of FOMO, like a fear of missing out over not living in the proximity, but they still have an impact in their local communities. And so I don't know. That's like a weird deconstructed way of thinking about it.
Okay, now then you're making me think I'm wrong. Maybe it's a great thing. Oh, Soleil, it has been great to talk to you.
Likewise. I'm so happy to be doing this.
Ruth Reichel's latest book is Save Me the Plums. Soleil Ho is restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and like they talked about, even if you don't live in her city, you should read her reviews at sfchronicle.com. Coming up, Bricia Lopez, the second generation owner of the iconic L.A. Oaxacan restaurant, Gelaguetza. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Obviously, there are tons of phenomenal Mexican restaurants in Los Angeles, but one of the greatest is in Koreatown. It's called Gelaguetza, opened as a place for the Oaxacan community to find a taste of where they came from. And eventually, the late great restaurant critic Jonathan Gold called it the best Oaxacan restaurant in the United States. Bricia Lopez grew up in that restaurant, taking it over when her parents moved back to Mexico, and is bringing their love of their culture to a new generation. She's the author of a beautiful new book called Oaxaca, Home Cooking from the Heart of Mexico. And she's with us now. Hola, Bricia.
Hola, Francis. ¿Cómo estás?
Bien, gracias. ¿Y tú?
Muy bien. I do love your Spanish capabilities, I will have to say that.
It's pretty much good for a hello, I'm well, and ordering on a menu. But
your accent is pretty on point.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But actually, okay, let's pretend I'm in a restaurant and I'm about to order on the menu, but I want to know a little bit something more about the place, and I'm going to ask you, tell us how your restaurant Gelaguetza got started.
Yes, the restaurant Gelaguetza was started by my father in 1994. So this year we turned 25, which is crazy to think. My dad migrated from Oaxaca and 93, and in 94 he opened up shop in a little place in Koreatown. It was a very, very small restaurant. And a few months after he opened, my mom, my siblings and I moved to LA, and all of us started working in the restaurant all the time.
But why did he open in Koreatown? Like, LA is such a Mexican city.
Yes. Well, this is Koreatown early 90s. So Koreatown early 90s was very Mexican. And
Oh, interesting.
A lot of Mexican community, a lot of Korean community.
And so you said you've basically been working at the restaurant since you came to the United States 25 years ago.
Yes, since I was 9 years old.
And I mean, for people who grow up in that kind of place, like, I mean, did you know you wanted to take it over one day? Or were you like, oh my God, get me out of here?
Oh, no, I did not want to do anything to do with the restaurant. I wanted to be, believe it or not, I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a news anchor. I wanted to be a radio host. Look at me now. I'm still fulfilling my dreams.
On the radio.
Yes, on the radio. I wanted to do everything but work in the restaurant because I always saw the restaurant as something that was taking my family away from me, in a sense, as a young girl, taking my parents' time, taking joy from my childhood. I would get so angry. I didn't get to go to prom because I had to work. I couldn't do sports after school. So I saw it as this, I hated it. I really did not like my time there as a high schooler. And when college came, this is what's funny though, when college came, I couldn't leave because something inside me didn't want to leave my parents alone. I felt the responsibility of being part of the restaurant. And I decided to go to school locally, to college, and continue working in the restaurant. And back then, it was in more back of the house, accounting, administration, because when you're a daughter of an immigrant, you're not only their translator, but also their attorney, you're their accountant, because my parents couldn't speak English. So my sister, she ran away. My older sister, she went back to Mexico for college. And then my brother went up north for college. And, you know, for a while, it was just me and my parents. And that's when I learned to fall in love with the process and understood, you know, the bigger picture. And it was really through college where I started seeing the restaurant as my career, but I was still finding that calling, I would say.
Yeah. But was there then like a moment where you knew you'd made the decision, or, you know, was there a moment where all of a sudden it was like, yeah, I guess I grew up here and I'm going to stay here?
The moment came when the recession hit and my parents lost everything. They lost their house, they lost their cars, they lost all the other businesses they had. They were stripped down from everything. It was a very, very dark period in our family's life. And they said, you know, I want to sell everything off. I want to pay all my debt and leave this country forever. And at that time, you know, I was sort of faced with this decision of either my dad sells everything off and moves, and I stay here because I'm not going to move to Mexico, and I have to get a job. And I think it was at that moment where it just kind of hit me, like, how am I going to go get a job? Hell no. But not only I'm going to go get a job, but it was also this, I was put in front of this image of my parents with nothing, like leaving without a legacy, leaving with all their years of sacrifice, like gone. And I just couldn't imagine me being part of that story. So at that moment, my parents did move back to Mexico, and my siblings and I, my sister, my brother, we got together, we formed a separate corporation, we drew up paperwork, and we said, okay, here's what's going to happen. We're going to buy this business from you guys. Obviously, we don't have money to pay, but we'll do it as a promissory note, and we'll send monthly payments. So consider it your pension or consider it your retirement plan. And in the beginning, it was really, really difficult. There were days where we didn't even have customers walk in, you know, it was hard. It was a recession. People didn't really have any money to spend, you know, but every day we would wake up and we would figure things out. We would, you know, tackle one problem at a time, and little by little, not only did the economy get better, but I think my siblings and I became better at what we were doing. We sort of found a role for one another within the business. And then from there, we just momentum.
What an incredible story. And I have to say, like, it feels great to be in there. It's a great vibe. And like, your food is so delicious. Like, your moles are so complex. You can taste the different spices and the seeds and the chiles and the chocolate and a little bit of the sweetness, but like a great mole, you can't really tell what's in it.
Right.
It's just like this bottomless pit of flavor. And every time I've tasted your mole, I'm like, oh god. Oh, so
thank
good.
You. Thank you. Well, you know, I think this is also another common mistake that people do when a restaurant is doing bad. The first thing they do is, how can we lower our food costs, right? As opposed to looking at operational. Yeah, what corners can we cut? And for us, it was more about, okay, what corners can we cut personally? You know, I didn't drive a car for years. We were, you know, we were living in wherever we could find cheap rent. Like, we just stopped taking money from the business. But we knew that one place where we needed to spend was actually increase our food costs so we can give people better quality food. We would go to Oaxaca and we would taste, we would go to the source and say, okay, this is what it needs to taste like. And my father always told me, it doesn't matter if you know how to cook or not, it matters that you know what things are supposed to taste like, because you can never fool someone who knows what things are supposed to taste like.
What does the restaurant's name Gelaguetza mean?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful name. My dad named it. Gelaguetza is a tradition in Oaxaca that's about receiving reciprocity, giving to one another, and just the act of giving and giving back and receiving at the same time. It's also a huge festival that I really encourage every single person to visit Oaxaca during the last 2 weeks of July. The only thing I can really compare it to would be Mardi Gras here in the U.S. It's just food and drink and dance. And there's a huge stadium that's called the Gelaguetza Stadium, where there are dancers from all the communities in Oaxaca. And the communities come to the city to share their culture with the world, to give their Gelaguetza to the world in this Gelaguetza Stadium. Yeah, and today for us, Gelaguetza, what it really means in our family and for everyone that works in the restaurant with us, is it's our way of giving our culture to LA, to give back to this wonderful city that we call home today.
Well, what a legacy. Thank you so much, Brizia.
Oh, no, thank you.
Brizia Lopez is the owner of Gelaguetza in Los Angeles, and her new book, it's a beautiful book, called Oaxaca, Home Cooking from the Heart of Mexico. She left us with a recipe from it called Picadillo de Pollo, and it's this delicious, sweet, and savory pulled chicken. Find it at splendidtable.org. Ed Levine had a pretty cool life as a food writer in the 90s.
He wrote basically whatever he wanted to for the New York Times, things like obsessive searches for the perfect hamburger, and Ruth Reichel called him the missionary of the delicious. Then he risked his and his wife's life savings to launch and run a website, Serious Eats, which was basically at the brink of closing for nearly a decade. He strained all of his relationships, his own mental health, and his future to keep it going, a story he wrote about in his new memoir, Serious Eater. But along the way, he met a young writer named J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, gave him a platform, and watched as Kenji became a superstar, his generation's voice on the science of cooking, and the best-selling author of The Food Lab. And we're here with them to talk about their relationship. Hey, Ed. Hey, Kenji.
Hey.
How you doing?
I hope you have 2 hours to talk about this relationship, Francis.
Well, 2 hours, but we'll super cut it down to 10 minutes, so it'll be great.
Because that's what couples therapy is all about.
I thought you guys were beyond that now.
But you know, we don't have any serious arguments. I don't think we've ever had any real serious sort of fundamental arguments, at least, the way couples do sometimes.
Yeah, that's the thing that people, I think, sometimes misunderstand about our relationship, Francis, is that, you know, even though Kenji wrote and writes about things that I could never write about, and maybe vice versa, we held so many things in common, like values and what we valued in good writing and proper research and good editing, that people think, oh, what could they have in common? And the fact of the matter is, as Kenji said, we have a ton in common. We actually have more in common than we do not.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, you kind of have to. But Ed, you wrote in the book that you've always had a knack for spotting talent. But a lot of the story is about your gathering talent for your original version of the site, your original vision of it, right? It was sort of a super blog, and there wasn't really an interest in you or in people who worked there in doing recipes. And then you found this talent, Kenji, who would kind of help remake the whole focus of the site. So what made you say, yeah, Kenji, please come write for us?
Well, Kenji had actually started writing for us. He wrote a couple of burger reviews for our now shuttered burger blog, A Hamburger Today. And while he was doing that, I think he was still working for Cooks Illustrated as an editor.
Yeah, I was working at Cooks Illustrated.
And it sort of became clear to me two things. One is that I couldn't ignore recipes. And, you know, in the book, I talk about my breakfast with Nick Denton, the founder of Gawker, where he asked me, what are you going to do about recipes? And I told him I didn't think the world needed another recipe database. And then he whipped out his phone and he said, how many recipe searches do you think there are a month on the internet? I was like, I have no idea. And he goes, I think the number now is 30 million. He said, if I were you, I'd figure out a way to do recipes Serious Eats style. And so I connected the dots between that conversation and Kenji's writing and what I knew to be his considerable skills as a recipe developer, because I used to read his stuff on Cooks Illustrated. So it was just like, this makes sense. And frankly, it was the way the web was moving, right? Because the kind of stuff I wanted to do, like, quickly became the realm of crowdsourcing information. And so, you know, the idea that there was so much value in me spending a month or two looking for the best cheeseburger in New York, or even the country for that matter, sort of seemed like not the right way to move forward. So when I met Kenji, and I was just like, and I don't even, to this day, I still don't know why. I guess I knew he went to MIT. Is that what it was, Kenji? I don't know why I suggested that he write a food science column. He had written, you'd written a little bit of food science stuff for Cooks Illustrated, right?
Yeah, well, it's because I was also the science, yeah, I was doing science stuff at Cooks Illustrated, and I'd written a couple things for Serious Eats, I think by that point, that had a little bit of like at least nerdy stuff in them, if not if not actual experimentation.
Yeah. But Kendrick, so Ed comes and offers you this gig for $30 a post.
right.
And why are you two laughing?
But what made you want to do it, and what made you want to do it with him?
Well, you know, so the first time I had contact with Serious Eats was actually when I had written a burger article for Cooks Illustrated. This was in 2007, maybe. And it was about grinding your own beef. And then Adam Kuban, who ran A Hamburger Today and who was the managing editor of Serious Eats, read that article and then did a little blog post about it, where I think a bunch of people tried to do it at home. And so this was the first time that, you know, I'd been writing for Cooks Illustrated for a couple of years, and I really enjoyed the sort of testing and experimentation and all that element. This was the first time that I'd seen like a piece that I'd written like sort of get a real quick and immediate reaction online and find the sort of a, you know, and so there was this post on A Hamburger Today, and then there was this community there that had all these comments about it and these conversations about it and these ideas. And so that was something that, you know, I'd never had before in any of my writing, this sort of like community element. And so that really attracted me to Serious Eats. And then so that was what made me, you know, email Adam and say, hey, like, let me write a few more things for you. Like, I saw you picked up my piece. Like, if you want, I can write a few things for you. And so I started off just doing silly burger posts because I wasn't really allowed to do recipes because, you know, I was under contract with Cooks Illustrated. I very immediately saw that, you know, Serious Eats had a sort of very similar set of values and ideas as me, you know, like taking food seriously, but not taking food seriously, but not taking yourself seriously. That was sort of the thing, you know, and understanding that, like, even if you like analyze a hot dog, at the end of the day, it's still just a hot dog, and finding sort of the humor in that, you know. So I think, you know, I really loved that culture at Serious Eats. And so it seemed an obvious, you know, when I moved to New York for other reasons, it seemed an obvious step to try and work with Ed. You know, I've always been someone who sort of places a lot more value on learning and trying new things than monetary compensation.
Yeah.
Luckily, I've been lucky in my life in that, you know, the compensation ended up coming at some point.
Sure. Yes.
But it was never sort of the guiding principle. And so the $30, you know, $30 an hour article, it seemed almost like a bargain to me. It's like, here's this guy sitting there telling me, like, I just gave you this idea for a food science column. Like, I basically just told you, like, this thing that you've been missing. And, like, you know, Ed, like, basically came up with my dream job and laid it at my feet. And I'd never considered doing that before. And I was like, you know what? This is what I was made to do.
Oh, and I get $30. It's pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I get to do what I want to do. And, like, my phone bill is covered. Yeah. You know?
So then you started writing this column. Well, two different columns, but eventually focused on the food lab, which later became the basis of your book, which is investigating cooking techniques through like a scientific point of view, which is wildly popular.
Yeah, specifically home cooking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was there a moment though when, you know, that started to take off for both yourself and for Serious Eats, the website, when you started to realize that you two were really invested in one another?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I'd had past business relationships and, you know, I've had bad relationships with bosses in the past and things that where I wished I got, you know, oh, I wish I got that in writing. I wish I'd paid more attention to this contract. And so that was always something I was a little bit wary of. It's like, you know, here's this guy, Ed, like he's not paying me too much. I know he's paying me as much as he can, but it's not much. And now his wife is my agent. And he's, you know, he's helping me by opening all these doors and giving me all these opportunities. But at the same time, it's like every step I take, I'm taking one further step into this relationship that's going to be impossible to detangle myself from if it ever comes to a problem. And, you know, it was one of those things where it's just like at some point you just have to put your trust in people. And Ed was a particularly easy person to trust. And thankfully he's never broken that trust for me. And I hope that I've never broken that trust with him. So it's, you know, it's proven to be a good relationship.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where we really, and I know this sounds trite, where we helped each other realize our respective dreams. So what better relationship could there be? Right. I mean, that's the ingredients for a happy marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for having us, Francis.
It was awesome. Thank you, Francis.
Ed Levine's new book is called Serious Eater. And J. Kenji Lopez-Alt's book is The Food Lab. And that is our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll
see you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and is supported by you. Thank you so much to everyone who supports our show and public radio in general. Subscribe to our podcasts at our website or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And we have a new one for you. None other than the New York Times food columnist Melissa Clark and her new podcast, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all about getting great food on your table Monday to Friday. She takes us into her kitchen and works through one terrific recipe every week. This week, it's Parmesan Dutch Baby, and it is real good. Don't miss it. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lupke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Chip Walton is our digital producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.